Saram, dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. With love and gratitude, we offer our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and as always, we pray that he speaks through both of us, myself, Prem, from Team Radio Sai, and with me, Arvind. Dear listeners, every week we take up a topic. But this week, instead of taking one topic, instead of taking one theme and delving into it, Arvind and myself are going to endeavor to do something a little different. We've done it before. But hopefully, we are able to bring some light through this discussion. Over the many weeks, many months, we've often got questions from our listeners asking about certain things, certain clarifications of Swami's message, or certain things, certain practices which we have in the Sai organization or in the devotee circle. We will be trying to take a few of those questions. Some of them are very spiritual in their nature. Some of them are practical in their nature. We will try to talk about them. We'll try to discuss whatever we know. It's not the last word, definitely. But whatever we can think of, whatever we have learned being in Swami's presence, and that's what is going to be our endeavor today. So before we go into the questions, let me invite Arvind, Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, Sairam dear listeners. Just as Prem said, it is really heartening for us when we receive feedback mail. And some of these mails contain questions, and Prem and myself, we both endeavor to take up each question or a doubt that is sought in these mails as a subject for an afternoon satsang. But invariably it has so happened that there are some questions that are, you know, not big enough in terms of being discussed for an entire satsang. At the same time, they definitely cannot be just neglected and ignored. So we just thought, like, a kind of taking a break from the usual style of satsang and, you know, finishing this so that it definitely takes a load off our heart also, because we feel that we owe this to all our listeners. And as Prem said, this is in no way going to be comprehensive. This is just our thoughts based on our own level of evolution and our reading and our understanding of Swami. Definitely, we will encourage more responses from everyone, but this is a way to begin answering the questions, if I can put it that way.
And before we start, I'm reminded of a couple of things. There's one philosopher, you know, whenever he would start his satsang, whenever he would start his meeting, he would always begin with this one particular theme. And I always find it very interesting. He would start by saying, "What I'm saying is not the truth. What I'm giving you is not the answer. What I'm telling you is not the ultimate understanding." And when the audience would be enough shocked, he would say, "Because the ultimate truth cannot be explained in words. The nature of that truth is that it cannot be phrased and, you know, given to you in the form of language which humans comprehend. So whatever I say can at best be described as pointers to the truth."
Exactly, Prem. You were speaking about a philosopher who begins his talks with that. I remember reading a book, I forget the name of the book, it's by Richard Bach, and he ends the book by saying that, again, I'm not able to get the exact quote, but the spirit of the quote is, "Every philosophy that you have heard in life need not be the ultimate or the only one, including this one." So that is a kind of a disclaimer he gives at the end of the book. And you were speaking about the philosopher who gives it in the beginning of the book. So yes, absolutely, there is no way to comprehend. At best, we are like those blind men trying to understand, feel an elephant. Each one of us speaks based on our experience. But at the same time, while, you know, the five blind men are testing out the elephant and none of them gets the true picture of the elephant, we cannot say that none of them have any picture of the elephant. Each person's version, when he says that the elephant is like a pipe holding the trunk, the other says that the elephant is like a wall touching the stomach, we cannot say that they are wrong. So each of those perspectives are right in their own way. It's just that it is not the entire picture. In the same manner, when we discuss these questions, yes, these are perspectives which are right in their own way, but they necessarily need not be the comprehensive and all-encompassing ones.
And that's about the answer which would be given to a question. And there's another little story about the question itself.
Mm.
You know, there's this man who goes to a spiritual master.
Mm.
And he says, "Master, I've been through the regular process of education. I've got a good job. I've earned enough money. I have a family. I have friends. I've gone after comforts. I've seen failures. I've seen success. I've seen happiness. I've seen sadness. But what is the very purpose of life? You know, at the end of all this, I'm faced with this question, what is the purpose of all this? I mean, what is the purpose of all this journey which we have gone through?"
Hmm.
The master will look at him and say, "This is the purpose." So he'll say, "What do you mean by this is the purpose?" He said, "All that you go through is so that one day you will stop and ask this question." And, you know, when all the while this person was thinking the answer to the question is what he's seeking, he didn't realize that all that he had gone through was to bring him to a situation where he would stop and ask this question.
Again, Prem, it reminds me of a movie. Basically, the protagonist in the story is seeking something and he has been given clues. These clues have been left behind by a deceased person. He's already passed on, and therefore what he has done is, these are holograms of his.
Mm-hmm.
So this protagonist comes up and he says, "No, why is this, what is happening over here?" And the hologram, or not the hologram, what do you call that? 3D, it's like
right.
A hologram, whatever. Holograph maybe. So of that person comes up and he says, "No, I don't know, I'm sorry." "No, I mean, why was this person murdered?" "I'm sorry." And you know, it goes on like this. Finally he says, "But what is the relationship between him and her then?" And he says, "Now that is the right question." And the holograph disappears. So the entire movie is based upon not hitting the right answer, but on asking the right question. And I found it so beautiful, the entire movie, in this concept. Because I feel spirituality is also about that. It's not about getting the right answers. It's about asking the right questions.
Absolutely. Because, you know, even the most spiritual of questions, Swami would ask, "Who am I?" You know, that's the question eventually all of us have to ask. Admit it, Arvind, you and I know the answer, right? We know the answer to the question, "Who am I?" Because we have heard it from Swami so many times.
Correct.
We have heard it from many masters. But the catch is, somebody like Ramana Maharshi, when he got to a position where to find an answer for that question was as important to him as breathing was. You know, that desperation with which that question comes is more important than even finding the answer. That is the reason, dear listeners, some of these questions we're going to take up. We are going to give answers from what we have read from Swami's books or what Swami has told and what other devotees have shared. But the most important thing is, when you are in a situation in life when you really want this answer and you're ready to do anything to find a proper resolution to this question which has arisen in your mind, I think that's the direction in which you're supposed to go, and that will give you the right purpose. And
the answer will come from within.
The answer will always come from within, as Swami would always say.
And that is why, you know, Swami even said about education. He said education, people
Absolutely.
Think, is stuffing what is external into the person. But it truly must be educare, which means to elicit, to draw out from within. Because the answers to everything lies within. The questions are the tools, the correct questions are the correct tools that we must employ to dig out these answers from within us. So as Prem said, the answers are definitely going to come from within.
In another beautiful analogy, maybe we'll stop with this, otherwise we'll keep going on, about questions and answers. We might have mentioned this before. The early astronomers, you know, when they wanted to see far into the sky, they would create better and better telescopes. I think one of the pioneers were Leonardo da Vinci and, you know, people of Galileo. Mm. Those were the people who would invent these machines which would help them see far into the skies. But with progress of science, suddenly they realized that after a certain point, you cannot see farther than this. For the simple reason that you have a blanket cover called the atmosphere, which kind of distorts the light which comes from far beyond. Okay, so this was the understanding the astronomers had. But if you look at what our sages and seers in our ancient India, in fact ancient world as such, what they found was all answers are within. And that which comes between you finding those answers is the thoughts in your mind. So always in all cultures, be it the Orient or be it, you know, the Greek philosophers, they always found that if you find a means of silencing the mind, if you find a means of making this mind still, then you will be able to dive within and find the answers for all the questions that you have.
And what is the link with that atmosphere astronomer?
Yeah, because in the external science, they found that there is this atmosphere which is distorting what is coming from outside. Similarly, the sages said the answers are always within. We are not able to find it because these thoughts are becoming like this atmosphere which is hiding it away. It's not that, that the answers are not there. Answers are always there. It's just that if you find a means of stilling this mind.
So that is why we have our telescopes on International Space Stations today.
Exactly. You have the Hubble Space Telescope, which is placed outside the atmosphere.
So we too need to see beyond the mind, right, just like we are able to see beyond the atmosphere. That's a very good analogy, Prem. With that, let me fire the first question. This is a question that has been asked in a few mails. And this is a question I have come across people asking in many fora too. The question is, what should I do when my parents don't get involved in the Sai organization and they also discourage me from doing the same? This question has been asked in other variants also. I want to join Swami's university, my parents don't want me to. Or I want to attend Bal Vikas, my parents don't want me to. So this is the first question. What should I do when my parents don't get involved and allow me to get involved in the Sai organization with Swami?
Maybe the spirit of the question is, it doesn't mention it, but it says that Swami says that you have to respect your parents.
Exactly.
So given that you have to obey your parents.
Yes, Matrudevo Bhava, Pitrudevo Bhava. They are the first gods.
Right. Then how do you place this contradictory situation where your parents don't allow you to come to Swami, and the very idea that you love Swami is the one which is stopping you from disobeying your parents?
Exactly.
It's a catch-22 situation. I think a couple of months back, we had sent out one Science Pious message, which was very beautiful, in which Swami, the first few lines, Swami says how the duty of a son or a daughter is to listen to the parents, how the duty of a dutiful wife is to obey her husband, and how a disciple should always respect his guru. Okay, the first few lines of the message was that, and saying that this is dharma. And then Swami, in the later part of the message, says, having said this, if there is a situation where your respect for these entities contradicts or clashes with your respect and love for God, always your love for God should win. And Swami goes on to give examples of like Prahallada who went against his father, like Mirabai who went against her husband, and like Bali Chakravarti who went against Shukracharya who was
his guru.
So I think what Swami is telling is, we are into practically how to avoid it. I think that's the next part of the question. How do you practically handle the situation? But technically speaking or morally speaking, always, and I think that should be our endeavor in everything, the first priority should go
to God,
Swami, to our love for Swami.
I remember this question was asked by a student in a Tri session. It was not directly asked to Swami. It had been offered on a piece of paper, which was read out to Swami, and I was present there when Swami answered this question.
Okay.
And Swami said, the question was this, that the students wanted to stay back in the summer vacation with Swami. But the parents tell you, come home. So the parents are saying, you come home, but we want to stay with you, Swami, what we should do? So Swami said, see, what you have feeling, noble feeling, that you want to be with Swami is very good. But if you feel your parents are telling you to come back, you should bring them onto the path where they encourage you to stick to God, because only he or she is a true friend who takes you on the path to God. Whoever it is, if they take you away from the path of God, he or she is not a true friend. That's what Swami said. But then, Swami, you know, in his beautiful, sweet Telugu, he would say, you tell Amma, Chudamma, with love, you speak to her mother, see like this, and, you know, with all love, explain. So, Swami said, the question is not about what to do, but how to do it. So, if we extrapolate that further, it comes to, as long as I don't fail in my duties as a son. See, if I want to say there is some pressing duty that I have to attend to, or whatever, something that I have to do possibly as part of my duty towards my parents, sometimes it also happens that to escape that, I'm looking to, you know, stay off with Swami. Am I trying to escape my duties and therefore telling I want to be with God? I have to be clear about that. Because, you know, another manifestation of the same thing is, if not parent, parent figure. For example, my work. I don't get a holiday to come and do seva and prashanti. I don't get my leave. They don't sanction it because they don't find it a good enough reason. I have to tell lies. So can I tell lies? Can I say somebody is sick and then come for seva? No, this is the other thing. So there also, to some extent, it boils down to, whether I'm doing my duty perfectly or I'm trying to escape my duty so in order I can do Swami's work. Because if I'm doing my duty perfectly and it's impeccable, naturally my boss will be impressed and will tell, definitely you deserve a vacation, take it wherever you want to.
Right.
So first thing we have to ensure is, we are not turning to Swami or turning to God to escape from our duties. And second thing is, if we are doing our duties well, we need not disrespect our parents and talk rudely to them. The how part always matters. Because Swami says, if you can't oblige, speak obligingly. I feel this is where we have to use that, to speak obligingly. Recently, I had attended a state conference in Odisha, in the state of Odisha. And interestingly, this question was posed even there. Okay. That is why, you know, we felt that this question is of such importance. And there was Mrs. Kamala Pandya, the National Bal Vikas Coordinator. She was answering.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave a very beautiful suggestion. She said, see, after you do your duty, after you are doing everything properly, there's one more thing you can do, which is pray to Swami. She said, we often underestimate the power of prayer. Prayer is such a magnificent tool. And in fact, in that conference, she just said, you sincerely pray, and within 15 days, if you don't see a change in your parents, my name is not Kamala Pandya. with that confidence and faith,
conviction.
She affirmed that conviction. So I feel one is doing the duty. Second thing is speaking obligingly and lovingly and trying to convince. And third thing is prayer. These are the three things we can practically do.
Really, it's a very wonderful point that you made, because oftentimes, you know, we all have sat in Kulanthal, we've seen dramas, we've seen the drama of, for instance, Sakubai, where there is this, she wants to go to Pandharpur and mother-in-law gives her a lot of work. And there is this interesting incident which happens where Vithala himself comes in the form of her husband, sends her off, and goes in the form of Sakubai and does all the housework.
Yes.
You know, whenever we see this, we kind of revere the devotee Sakubai and all that. But one of the main differences that Swami as an entity has done to all our lives is, that is possible even in my life. That can happen even to me. You know, it is not a lofty devotee, because we might not be a devotee as great as Sakubai, but the Lord who came to Sakubai is the same Lord who is coming to us. He is capable of doing anything. I think that confidence is what the entity like Swami, an avatar, a guru can do in your life. That's one thing. And the other thing is, I think the love for God is something like embers which are covered by an ash. The more the wind blows, the more stronger the embers will be. So nothing can actually quell the real love that you have for God in your heart. And no situation in family, in work can actually put it away. In fact, I'm reminded of what happened to one of my classmates. He was working in a research firm in Bangalore. And during one of the alumni meet in Puttaparthi, he went to his boss, who was very, very skeptical, a scientific-minded person, who was completely dismissive about all these Babas and Gurus and all that. And he had a special corner for Swami in that chamber of hatred, if you could say that. And from the beginning, when he came to know that this particular boy was from Swami's university, he did not miss an opportunity to do a little bit of poking. So this boy had his fair share of heartburns with this particular boss of his. So one day he went up to his boss and said, sir, I just want a couple of days off because I'm going for the alumni meet. So that was it. The floodgates opened and a barrage of accusations. And he said, you're all learned youngsters. Why do you go behind all these things and all that? And he said, you're trying to escape duty. I've given you an experiment and you don't want to do it, and you're just giving me this reason, you're walking off. So this boy felt very hurt, and he said, all right, sir, I don't want the leave. My heart is there, it doesn't matter, you don't have to give me the leave, and he walks off. So this happens a few weeks later, and you know, there's a little bit of cold which is there between the two, the boss and the employee. One fine day, around 8:30 in the night, this particular boss, before he goes home, he thought, let me just go into the lab and have a look and go. So he goes into the lab, and see the beautiful way Swami arranges it. He goes inside. There are 8 boys standing there and working overtime. They're supposed to work till 6. Till 8:30, there are some boys sitting and doing experiments. He looks around. All those 8 students were students from Swami's university.
Wow.
Okay, and all of them were working unmonitored. They were just trying to finish their work, which they wanted to do it sincerely. And that brought a complete change in his whole perspective of Swami and Swami's students. You know, I think that is how Swami works. Swami has many times told, as you said, you just stick to what you're supposed to do, and really you can believe and you can trust that Swami will do what is necessary to be done to take you out of that situation.
I'm not remembering a specific example now, Prem, but during the alumni meet, I remember hearing at least two episodes where it has come to the neck, and when the student actually just said, I leave it to Swami, I am not running away from my duty, I have finished everything. This is just the attitude of my boss, which he is not allowing me. So I am ready to face whatever, and they have come here. We have heard of how Swami went in their place and did the job in their form at their workplace. So really what happened in Sakubai's story can happen in our lives too. So it's just about we not forgetting. We see and admire that episode in Sakubai's life, but let us, as you said, let us realize that it is very much possible in our life also. Let us never give up the power of prayer. The second question, Prem, is also along the similar lines. You know, it says, what should I do if my children do not take to Swami? You know, that was about a child asking about parents. Now, this is about, I am in Swami's fold, I am interested, but you know, my children are too modern, they feel Swami is no good, Swami is no use. Mom, Dad, you do what you want, just let us alone, don't impinge on our freedom. That is the second question. You know, what I feel is the spirituality is a very, very personal journey. You may be mother and son, you may be father and daughter or whatever in the drama called life. But in spirituality, we all are individual beings seeking out our own salvation. So I feel as a parent, this is something that has to be kept in the back of the mind. It is just like, for example, Sachin Tendulkar, the cricket player, cannot put the heavy burden of being a top-notch cricket player on his son. In the same way, Diego Maradona cannot say that my child has to be a star footballer. It is the same way, you cannot say that, you know, I am maybe a state president, maybe I am a national vice president, maybe I am a youth coordinator, maybe whatever. I am a PSI student, and therefore my son or my daughter also should be, they should live up to my glory or be grander. I mean, you understand the spirit of my words. Yes. It would be a wrong thing to do, and it would be a very, very detrimental thing for our own spiritual progress, I feel. Because our children or whatever, for some reason, for some spiritual reason, they have been chosen to come in that family. So we have to give that freedom. At the same time, you know, I feel we can look at Swami's schools for a good example here. In the primary school level, the kids, the children, they are told, you have to do this. You just better do it. Okay? And they just do it. The children follow it. They follow the schedule. They do the suprabhatam. They do their prayers. It's like you just believe what we are saying and you'll see. You have faith in what we say and you will see it working for yourself. And you have no choice. You have to do it. I feel that's good at that age. Once they move on to higher secondary school, they are told, you have to do this because, you know, and they are given the reasoning. This is why you have to do it. This is how it is. They are given the reasoning, but again, they are not free to choose what they want. So you got the reason now, your intellectual curiosity is satisfied, now you better do it. But once it comes to the university, it's a different thing. You know, for examples, we had situations where there would be people missing darshan because they are busy in their research.
Right.
But that would be no way to say that they have less love for Swami, because their sole objective would be to produce mind-boggling research that will glorify the name of Swami, and the same Swami for whose darshan they did not come would call them, put a shawl on them and publicly honor them with medals and trophies or whatever when they win accolades from around the world because of their sincerity and hard work. So once it comes to university level, they are told, of course, but it is just told like an advice given from an elder. It is totally left to their choice. Doesn't mean that the teachers and elders stop advising. They continue to give advice, but the elders and teachers don't have heartbreaks or heartburns if they don't see their advice being explicitly followed. Because we never know, implicitly it might be being followed. Because now they are also adults, we should allow them to use their own discrimination. Because you can't, you know, hold the hand and walk throughout life. Sometime they have to walk and run on their own, so it is a time to let go. So I feel the same thing will hold good depending on what kind of child you are parenting. If it's, say, it's a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, no, you have to go to Balvika's class, you have to do it. It's a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, you have to go to Balvika's class because this is like this, but you better go. When they cross 18 years, see, we feel you should do. But it's left to them. Because if for 18 years you have not been able to make it, it's not any certainty that another year or two will make a difference. So this is, once they have crossed that age, what I feel is you have to give them the total freedom, respect them as adults, be less of parents, be more of a friend, but never stop loving, never stop sharing your views and advice.
I think that's a perfectly balanced, practical advice. In general, if you look at it, I'm reminded of what one of our wardens in the hostel shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
When he first became the warden, suddenly you're put into a situation where there's so much of responsibility on you, because you are trying to prepare youngsters to receive the best gifts an individual can get. That is being in the presence of Swami. So he was going all out to ensure that these boys would follow all the disciplines and, you know, they'd be good. And there would always be the black sheep. You can't discount that. So he was feeling that how are these boys, there are these few boys who are not able to, you know, enjoy the Swami's grace completely because of their lack of discipline. And, you know, he was losing sleep over it. And he was saying one day he was just taking a walk after dinner and wondering, what is this? You know, how do I handle this? Am I failing in Swami's duty? You know, this is one thing which a lot of parents might get into. Not being able to get my child to the fold or to obey what Swami would say. Am I failing as a parent? You know, that was the situation he was in. He was thinking about, am I failing as a warden? Am I failing as a trustee of these children because Swami has given me this work? And just as he was thinking this and walking, one of the students walks up to him and says, sir, there's a letter for you. It was a postcard. Okay. And when he looked at it, he was so surprised because that postcard was from Swami. Because that time Swami used to write a lot of letters to the hostel and the warden. And Swami had written him a postcard. Okay. And he was surprised. He looked at it and he started reading. And in that Swami had written and kind of describing very shortly what he was going through in his mind. Saying that you're thinking like this. Then Swami told him, your duty ends in telling. Your duty does not extend to the point of making them do it. And they following or not following is not your responsibility. He says, your duty ends in telling it and telling it in the best manner possible. Whether they do it or they don't do it, it's completely up to their prapti. This is what Swami had told him. And he said it was so clear because now the situation completely changes, because he said, till now I was thinking I have to ensure that these guys fall in line. Immediately in one letter, Swami has changed it to, this is my sadhana. I have to try as much as possible to do it. And in the process of trying lies my sadhana. Whether the result is what it is, does not depend on my sadhana.
I feel, Prem, that it becomes more intense of a sadhana when it comes to parents. Because, you know, as a warden, I feel it's possibly easier. You know, you have 300 students, 15 of them are bad, 20 of them are bad. I've got the other 280 to concentrate on.
Fall upon.
What if I have two children and one of them, it's half of my children. So that way, as you said, I think it's a beautiful thing because it becomes an intense sadhana for the parents also to free themselves of attachment, to love without getting attached, to be involved without being attached. It's a great sadhana and it's a great lesson to learn.
I think that is the essence of sadhana, because at the end of your spiritual journey, you want to give up all attachment and the feeling of doership. And if you're saying that, no, I want to be attached, I want to ensure that my children are good and I want to be proud of their achievements, it is natural, but I think that is the tendency we are all working against. And for this question and the question before that, what I'm thinking is something I was telling one of my friends who was going through a little bit of a rough patch in their life, you know. And I was telling this person that, see, I have surrendered to Swami. Okay, I have the feeling that I'm devoted to Swami and I accept whatever Swami does is good for me. But the funny part is nothing is going wrong in my life. So I can happily celebrate the surrender. I am not sure whether this surrender is foolproof. But Swami has thrown you into a situation where you can test your surrender for yourself. He has thrown you in a situation where you can test for yourself how much you love Swami. So I feel everybody who is going through a, you know, phase where their parents are obstacles in their journey to Swami, where their children are not, you know, falling in line in their journey to Swami, this is an opportunity which Swami has given to for you to prove to yourself how much you love Swami, how much Swami is more important to you than everything else. So I think we have to accept it with open arms. It's really an opportunity. Any difficulty in that sense is really an opportunity.
Hope you are enjoying this, dear listeners, because there are new insights that are emerging for us. Even as we discuss this, we are grateful to Swami for that. We'll take a little break. As you enjoy this song, We will come back soon, and there are more questions to follow after this.
So dear listeners, we're going to take a song break, and the other interesting thing we'll try to do is we're going to play some old bhajans throughout this satsang, maybe a 2-3 nice nostalgic old bhajans. So hope you all enjoy it along with us.
मन मंदिर में दीप जलावो, मन मंदिर में दीप जलावो, जीवन ने लगावो, जीवन नैया पार लगावो, सदा निरंतर हरि गुण गावो,
सदा निरंतर हरि गुण गावो,
से भजन सुनावो,
प्रेम भक्ति से भजन सुनावो,
प्रेम भक्ति से भजन सुनावो,
प्रेम भक्ति से भजन सुनावो,
सदा निरंतर हरि गुण गावो,
सदा निरंतर हरि गुण गावो,
साईं नाथ के चरणों में आवो,
साईनाथ के चरणों में आवो,
साईनाथ के चरणों में आवो,
साईनाथ के चरणों में आवो,
मन मंदिर में दीप जलावो, जीवन ने पार लगावो, जीवन ने पार लगावो,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of an interesting discussion. We've taken two questions. We're going to take the third one, and it's going to be my chance to throw it to Arvind now. Okay, the third question is quite an interesting one. How do I love God and worship Him when I myself am in such pain and suffering? I think it's a question which a lot of people really must be having in their mind.
Yes, you know, because I'm sure you and me also would have felt it at some point of time in our lives.
Very true.
As to, Swami, when there are some family problems going on, or when there are financial problems going on, or there are academic problems, I have failed. You know, when my mind is occupied with all these problems, how can I find, you know, time for God? When we think of this, Prem, you know, the question appears to be like, correct. It is only when our mind is freed of all these worries, can we now think of Swami? In fact, that is one reason why Swami says that we have to keep a healthy body. We have to maintain good physical health, because a healthy mind in a healthy body. Swami tells us that if our body is diseased and suffering, then all our attention and focus will be on the body. In order to transcend and give up the body, we have to maintain the body. That is what all our spiritual masters have told us. So, what about the mind then? In order to transcend the mind, I mean, should we not give up the mind? And how can we give up the mind if all these problems are there, misery?
Right.
It's a slightly different case here, because, you know, practical experience teaches us that somehow we think of Swami, we think of God only when we are in pain, suffering, and when we are not so happy. Whenever we are happy, we just forget. That's why there's that famous story where a man goes to heaven and God says, this is a prayer receiving department which works overtime, and there's another department which is a prayer granting department which works overtime, and finally the gratitude receiving department is jobless. Because people don't we often think we express when things go well, when we are happy. We don't express gratitude, because when things are not going well, how are we able to express gratitude? We are only going to complain. When things are going well only, we can express gratitude, but we don't do it. Because whether we are ready to accept it or not, the only time when we can think about Swami, or when we think or feel Swami, pray to Swami, is when we are actually suffering. Suffering is almost a blessing in that sense. And that is why, you know, Mother Kunti, if we see in the Mahabharata, when Krishna asks her what does she want, she says, Lord, promise that I'll have my life filled with suffering. And Krishna is surprised. He says, what are you asking? And she says, yes, Krishna, because whenever I suffer, I think of you. And if I want to spend my life thinking of you always, I want suffering to be my constant companion. So in that sense, suffering and pain is a blessing that comes, which ensures that we are able to think of God. And if we are not able to think of God, how can we love God? So if I feel the minute, you know, that is what we discussed in the concept of three zeros also, right? The minute we say, Swami, we want you. Suddenly we see financial problems coming, health problems coming, relationship problems coming. Because before gifting us the greatest treasure in the universe, that is God Himself, God says, do you want me or do you want health? Do you want me or do you want relationship? Do you want me or do you want money? Do you want me or do you want your self-respect? And like Draupadi, once we give up everything, say, no, don't want Lord, we just want you. Then the greatest gift is bestowed on us. So, if the question is asked to me as to how can I love God and worship Him when I am myself in suffering, I feel suffering is the beginning when we start contacting God and start loving Him. So it is very, very essential. That is what I feel.
Right. I think it's a beautiful answer, because especially this Mother Kunti's example has been mentioned many times by Swami. A little more generic answer which I can think of is, you know, this is a question which is very, very often asked. Here it is asking, when I'm suffering, how can I think of God? It could even be the converse. When I'm praying to God, how come I'm getting suffering in my life?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, things like that. I'm good, why bad things happening to me? Mm-hmm. Forget, take God out of the picture. It's just that when I'm good, I've never done, you know, anything bad to anybody. How can bad happen to me? You know, there is a certain pattern you can see in what spirituality tries to teach us. We've often spoken about being in the now, doing things for the now. If you look at it, everything that we do it for some future benefit in mind.
Or based on past experience.
Yeah, past experience. Past experience, because we know that if I do this, I get this.
Correct.
So I'm doing this now because I want to get that. Okay. Always we do something with an eye on what is coming as a result. And if you see, the essence of the entire Bhagavad Gita is, are you able to do without expecting anything in return? So the entire, I feel, the idea of spirituality itself is to sever this connection between what I do and what I expect in return for what I do. The basis of all spiritual understanding and explanation is, can you do this? Can you cut what I'm going to do from what I'm going to receive for what I'm doing now? And that is why you would always see, why do good people get cruel people coming and, you know, being cruel to them? The question is, will you still be good? Are you being good because good is giving me a profit in future? Or are you being good because you're going to be good? So it's an opportunity for you to separate being good and what you get in return for being good.
And if that's not enough, God will amp it up and make a cruel or bad person seem to get all good things in life.
Right. I mean, when that equation in your mind is totally shattered, when the logic which you've placed in your mind is totally shattered, will you still be good? Because the idea is not just to be good, but to be good for goodness sake. And similarly, I think even in your relationship with God, even in the context of prayer, I think it's the same thing. Yes, you pray, you get good things. You pray for relief, you get relief. You pray for Swami's grace and you get the grace. But at some point, I think Swami will put us through the process where you're praying, but you're still suffering. You're seeking sincerely, but you still don't get what you seek. Will you still pray? Will you still seek? In our relation with Swami, everything else will go through a similar process, where at some point, the connection between what you do and what you will get for what you're doing will be severed, and an opportunity will be given to you to see whether you will still do it.
In fact, Prem, I think you have answered in a little part the next question too. The next question is a little challenging one, definitely. The question is, yes, you know, you have pointed out so many times where it becomes tough to, you know, pray to God when our prayers are not being answered, or be good when we see goodness not being rewarded. So the next question is, of such moments, how do we ensure that we always make an effort to follow Bhagwan, especially in weak moments? Let us define weak moments as moments when we succumb to the six enemies, that is, Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madha, Matsarya. When greed or desire or ambition, envy, any of these, anger, when these strike us in those weak moments, how do we ensure that we are following Bhagwan?
I think that's a really tough question, and I'm not sure we can answer it with the authority of practice. We can, of course, only answer it with the authority of
in practice, you know,
knowledge.
The easiest way to overcome temptation, as they say, is to succumb to it.
Is to succumb to it. You know, the beauty of this is, Swami would often say, and I think we've narrated this many, many times before, Swami would, any number of times he has told, that whatever you do in life right now, you're doing it out of practice. Because you're practiced to do it. We all have come from animal life, and technically speaking, we should be on our foes. And even as children, we were always either on our back or on our foes. It is with practice, it is by, you know, in the environment we've been put, we've been told that you're supposed to walk on your 2 feet. And that is why after all the falling and falling and falling, we've started walking in 2 feet. I think similarly, temptations in life, as long as we know that I'm supposed to overcome this, you know, my reality, my real identity is when I am beyond this temptation. When you know that that is your destination, and if your journey and if your practice and your efforts are all in that direction, you might be faltering here and there, but I think every time you fall, you'll be ready to pick yourself and walk forward. And it is not like, you know, suppose imagine as a child I started walking and the 2-3 times I fell, I say, well, probably I'm not meant to walk on my 2 feet, let me continue on my fours. You know, that would be such a stupid thing to do. Similarly, I'm sure everybody has our weak moments. You know, there are some temptations which I can easily overcome, but there are some temptations which I'm weak at. It could be the converse for you. You know, that which I'm easily fall a prey for, it might be your strong point.
Exactly.
So I think each one of us are in this duel with ourselves where we're conquering it. And I think that is also the way Swami looks at us. When Swami looks at us, Swami does not see where we are, but Swami sees where our intentions are. Are we trying to pull ourselves up?
In the previous question, you were answering it saying that the Bhagavad Gita says that the efforts matter, the results don't. I think that statement, which was like a very testing one while answering the previous question, comes to our rescue in this question. You know, the beautiful thing is, when we know that it is a weak moment, and we are trying our best to overcome it, even if we succumb to it, if we are sure that we have put in our best effort, you know, that is enough, because God sees efforts and not the results. So I might not succeed in overcoming the temptation or preventing myself from getting angry. In fact, I remember I myself asked Swami, Swami, how to overcome anger? This was when I was in 12th grade. And years later, I don't think I've overcome anger. But I definitely know that consciously, whenever I get conscious, I have been putting in a lot of effort. And, well, I don't want to go into details of how I feel Swami has rewarded me, but the fact holds that Swami has rewarded me. And I feel Swami has rewarded me not because I have conquered anger, but because I am making efforts to conquer anger. So I feel it is so important that in those weak moments, we put in efforts. Say, for example, if it's a temptation. If it's a temptation, I'm trying to resist. And this time, I did it for 3 days. For 3 days, I've resisted it. And I succumbed to it, possibly. Next time, can I resist it for, say, 3.5 days? 4 days? 5 days? Can I increase? So, it's just like building up my endurance. Till a day comes when I'm able to easily let go of it without it bothering me. So, that is definitely going to happen, because as you said, everything comes with practice. When we are riding the bicycle, the first time, every 30 seconds we must be falling. For me, when my father taught me to ride the bicycle, he would be running.
It really looks like something which is out of the world. It cannot happen.
It just, exactly.
No, I'm reminded, when you say bicycle, the number of times while learning to ride a bicycle, you have that pleasant dream of you having conquered it in your riding, because that is like climbing the Mount Everest.
Exactly. And you know, and it happens in a snap, Prem.
Right, exactly.
Because
you don't realize when you've learned it.
It is not as if that in the beginning you're falling once in 10 seconds. That happens. Then you start falling once in 20 seconds. And it doesn't continue like that. It's not as if you start falling once in a minute. After some time you start falling once in 10 minutes. Never. Somehow after that minute, you never fall again. You just never fall. And days will pass, you will not fall. And it's possibly an accident or some unfortunate thing that you fall. Otherwise, you just don't fall. After that, you don't ride it for 10 days. You don't ride it for 10 years. You take it back. Again, you don't fall. So, it's not as if that even that is the thing we should take solace from. It's not as if today I'm not getting angry for 5 days, for 6 days. It's not as if it'll keep taking 7 days, 8 days, 10 days, 11 days. And in one moment it'll suddenly snap and that's it. I would have conquered anger. So the important thing is, as long as we are sure that we are putting in 100% effort and we are making it a practice, we are practicing, because the 90-second blow breaks the rock, but it doesn't discount the 91 blows that you have hit on the rock before. So, as long as we are 100% sincere in our effort, I feel Swami has been absolutely fine with we succumbing to temptations, succumbing to mistakes. He's a most loving and forgiving Lord. So, continue with the effort and never lose hope and never lose optimism.
And you know, if you look at Swami's approach in that sense, you can see distinctly two things which Swami does. If you listen to Swami's discourse, Swami always paints that picture of the perfect you which he wants. You know, he would talk of that Advaitic state where he's saying, how can you have desires? How can you have attachment? You are divine. So Swami is unrelenting when he paints that picture of the perfect you.
Correct.
And there is no compromise there. Mm. And that's why when Swami is sometimes saying that, I don't know, I personally feel sometimes Swami is harsh. You know, when he's saying that this is what I want. You know, nothing less than the best. Nothing less than 100% is agreed to me. But in his approach in making you get there, Swami is actually very, very lenient. You know, when he looks at you, when he sees that you're doing mistakes, when he sees that you're following, I think that approach in trying to get you there is much, much more lenient. Because Swami, when he comes there, he says that don't associate yourself with that sin. Don't associate yourself with that failure. Because perfection is where you have to reach. But in the process, I think that's the very, very clear difference between Swami's approach and the approach of many, many masters, where, you know, the role of guilt is overplayed. You know, when you're doing something wrong, when you've done something wrong, you have to repent, you have to repent, you have to consider yourself a sinner, you have to, you know, feel bad for it. But with Swami, the approach is completely different. Swami says you are divine. Suppose you're walking, you fall and you fall into a pool. No, you go and wash yourself. You don't start telling, I'm dirty, I'm dirty, I'm dirty, oh, I'm dirty. Because you are very clear in your hide, in your mind, the filth is separate from me. I am not the filth.
Or in other words, if you're walking and you fall, You don't get up and tell, I don't know to walk, I'm good for nothing, right. I don't know to walk, nothing. I had a fall. Accept it and I'll be more careful and I'll walk. So that sincerity in effort is essential. But I think, yeah, we have to move on just as we have to move on to the next question.
Right. I think, and before we go to the next question, let's quickly play out another beautiful old bhajan. So dear listeners, stay tuned. At the end of this bhajan, again, we'll take up another question. Welcome back, dear listeners. And now it's my turn to ask the question, Arvind. I think you'll have to go first.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this again is an interesting question. It's definitely from a person who's looking at leading a spiritual life. Is it wrong to have ambitions and desires in life?
You know, we can see where this question will arise from. We have the Ceiling on Desires program.
Right. We glorify acceptance a lot.
We glorify acceptance. We glorify detachment.
Detachment, right?
Yes. So you be detached. And even now we were saying that only. You just put in efforts. Don't worry about results. So is it wrong to aspire? Is it wrong to aspire and have ambition? You know, this question, you cannot answer it generically because it depends. You know, that is a beautiful answer for any question. It depends.
Just when you said it depends, I'm really... The moment you said that, it struck me. Sometime back, you had written a wonderful article on Dr. Chai.
Huh.
He would begin every answer with, it depends.
Okay.
You ask him any question, spiritual, medical, or mundane, he would always answer, start with, oh, it depends.
It depends. That's a honest answer, that's a truthful answer, right. And a very safe answer. So, I also use Dr. Chai's words and say, it depends. Professor Kasturi, I remember, I don't remember the exact words, but he has written about the avatar. And it's so beautiful because he stayed in proximity of the avatar and he was not only near to the avatar, he was very dear. And Professor Kasturi sir writes that the avatar comes to wake the sleeping, to make the sleeping sit up, to make the sitting stand, to make the standing march. To make the marching reach. And so you see, it's the avatar comes as an overall nitro booster. You know, it boosts everyone in whatever stage of life they are in. And so therefore, a person who is already marching will not have ambition because he's already marching. He has to reach. So, I would like to take recourse to what Swami says about the gunas. He says, our entire life is an interplay of three gunas. Tamasic, which is lethargy.
Sloth.
Rajasic, which is activity, ambition, passion. Sattvic, which is, you know, soothing, serene, peace, calm. Swami says, but even that is a guna. To attain God, you have to go beyond the gunas. You have to go beyond sattva and then you attain God. So in that sense, if one is leading an inactive life, a slothful life, a tamasic life, then in that case, it is definitely fantastic to have ambition and desire, to have some passion in life. Rather than lead a life like a clod of earth, it is better to think that I am supposed to achieve this. I am supposed to do this. And I'm again, you know, reminded of a beautiful shloka. Again, I don't know the number of the shloka, which chapter it is from the Bhagavad Gita, where Lord Krishna speaks of inactivity and activity. You know, he says it begins with inactivity, which is tamas, sloth. In order to spiritualize them, you need rajas, which is ambition, energy, you know, desire. So it is better than being slothful. So from inactivity, you move to activity. But then, you know, the next change comes where you see the inactivity in activity.
Right.
Because you see that how much ever work you do, you don't seem to be attaining the result. And how much ever work someone is not doing, he seems to be getting it. So you realize that the activity is actually very inactive. And that is a stage where, you know, questions begin to arise. And a rajasic person starts meeting disappointments because an ambitious person is looking for results. And after seeing the inactivity inherent in activity, one begins to realize the activity that is inherent in inactivity. Just to be unruffled, steady and calm, it requires tremendous activity. How much of effort we have to put in not to get elated by joys, not to get depressed by sorrows. So that is when you start seeing the activity in inactivity. And having seen that, you move to the level of inactivity, but this is not a tamasic inactivity, this is the inactivity we associate with yogis. So though the highest level and the bottommost level appear to be the same, they are very different. And therefore, if we are in tamas and we are not doing anything, we are in a state of inactivity, then ambition, passion and desire is good. But if we are in a state where we are desiring and we have ambitions which are not being met and we are getting frustrated more and more, most possibly we are in that stage. That is why we are asking whether is it wrong to have ambition. Then yes, it is wrong to have ambition in terms of what we wish to achieve. Our ambition should be restricted to what efforts we wish to put, because only efforts is in our hands, not the results.
Very beautiful. I think the whole confusion stems from the desire to find out what is the best way out. You know, many times, especially when you talk about bhakti, jnana, karma and all that, very often you would, at the end of a discourse of explanation of all these three, people will ask, okay, tell me what's the best. Because you've given me three choices, I want to choose what's the best. So always we are trying to say, tell me what's the ideal, I want to get there. But spirituality is never a leap from one state to the other. It is actually a gradual transformation. And that is why Swami always says about, you know, sublimating each of your innate passions which are there. You know, when you have a passion for change, turn it into passion for good change. You know, when you have ambition, instead of being an individual ambition, can you make it a group ambition? Can you make it an ambition for a society? Ambition for the betterment of the downtrodden. That is the only way, because you would see that, you know, Swami has mentioned this before also. You would see in a setup like our ashram, you know, you would expect everybody who comes and settles in an ashram to seek a very sedate and, you know, calm and peaceful life. But even in an ashram, you would see a little bit of realignment based on who desires a little more power, who desires a little more influence, maybe even for the good reason. I'm not saying it's a negative thing. But you would see that realignment happening because these are all based on the individual's passions and
tendencies
inside. And in fact, I think in one of the Vahini, Swami makes this beautiful point when he's talking about communism and socialism in particular. Swami said the idea was good. The idea of bringing equality in society is good, but you cannot bring in equality unless there is equality of desires, which is not a reality. Okay, Swami said it's not possible. You know, you could all put them in the same line, but at the end of the day, they will all realign themselves. You know, I think there's a story which is a folklore, which they say that there is a king who desires that he wants everybody to be equally rich. So he gives the equal amount of money to everybody, divides his wealth to everybody. So he starts with a point where everybody is as rich as the other. Then he says 10, 15 years down the line, automatically there are some people who cannot keep quiet, so they want to do something. There are some people who don't have the need for the money, so they give it away. There are some who are, you know, desirous of the money, so they become businessmen.
Some who cheat, some who
get so
cheated.
10, 15 years down the line, it again comes to the same situation he started off with. Because there cannot be external equality. So similarly, if you ask that, should I have passions, should I have ambitions, should I not have? If I say you should not have, can you stop having? It cannot be given up in one day. So the ideal thing is, Swami has given the ideal in front of us. Desirelessness is the ideal stage we have to reach. But the means to reach that is, I think, sublimating each of these tendencies which are in each one of us.
You brought up a very nice point by saying, can I have, instead of personal ambition, can I have societal ambition? Can I have ambition for the entire earth, for my country? That's a very, very noble idea. I remember seeing a version of the Mahabharata. There are many versions of the Mahabharata. In the Mahabharata, when Karna is on his deathbed, you know, Karna is like a kind of a tragic hero in the Mahabharata, who has all the virtues, who is very powerful, very skillful, and yet he's on the wrong side and he's dying. And that time he asks Krishna, the Lord, he says, Lord, what was my fault? Why did I suffer this? And Swami says that Krishna tells, it's a company, you're bad company. You took the side of Duryodhana, who was adharma. He says, but Lord, he is the only one who stood by me. Is loyalty to a friend wrong? He questions Krishna. I am just being loyal to a friend who gave me my life. When God gives life, you're loyal to God. No, somebody else has given me my life, my livelihood, everything. So why am I being faulted? And Krishna says, you know, you confuse between giving to a mortal and giving to God. God does it out of selflessness. Did Duryodhana give you all this selflessly? He wanted you, he saw your skill, he saw how it's going to be useful to him. It was out of selfishness he gave, so that we will leave aside. But then Krishna brings about another beautiful point, according to that serial. Okay. But it was a very nice point. He says, Karna, you were given the skill, you were given the ability. And society put you down as a son of a charioteer. I agree that society should not be divided based on birth, but based on skills. If you are a good archer, you have to be a good archer, irrespective of whether you are born to a charioteer or whether you are born to a king. So that way it was good. You used your skill, but do you know there are 100 other such people in society who suffer, who are skillful archers, who are skillful and able administrators, but just because of their birth, they have not been able to progress. But Karna, you were different. You were also given the opportunity. Did you utilize the opportunity to uplift all those others who have been similarly downtrodden in life? No, you used it only for yourself. That is another fault of yours, Karna, Krishna says. And so therefore, when we might have our own ambitions and our own desires, but if we are able to align that ambition and desire for the society, it gets elevated to heights of nobility. What might seem wrong at an individual level gets justified at a societal level. Therefore, while murdering a person is wrong, Arjuna killing thousands in the battle of Kurukshetra becomes right. Because Krishna tells him, if you are doing this for you to win the kingdom, it's wrong. But you do it for dharma, it's fine. So this is a nice way of, you know, making our ambitions and passions work in our favor by sublimating it and using it for the benefit of society or a larger community at large.
Very, very beautiful point, because I think it's a very practical way of doing it. We cannot remove and throw away the ambitions and passions in our life, but can you inject that selflessness into these tendencies? You know, and that is what we have seen in the life of many, many great masters, be it Aurobindo, be it Mahatma Gandhi, be it Vivekananda or, you know, Subhash Chandra Bose. You know, they all were people of action. They had to do something to change. They cannot sit back and wait for change to happen. Hmm. You know, all these characters were like that. But what they did was, the desire for change, they brought it from an area which was absolute selflessness. And when that happened, somebody like Subhash Chandra Bose or even Aurobindo Ghosh, they could recognize till where their effort lied. You know, they did not go over and go at it relentlessly and, you know, get obsessed with their action and their ambition. They knew at some point when your act or even that obsession comes out of selflessness and you're ready to, you know, sacrifice yourself in the process of that ambition, I think you will get that wisdom when you say that, okay, this is where my role ends. That's what happened with Aurobindo Ghosh. I mean, at one moment he said, you know, I don't have to work this way for the independence of this country. My role changes now. And it is really same thing happened to Subhash Chandra Bose, because there is that one story that he didn't die in the air crash and, you know, he went away and became a yogi in Himalayas. If we were to believe that story, I think that would have been the same predicament which Aurobindo Ghosh went through. So I think that's a very practical thing. It's not possible, whether it's right or wrong, it's not possible to do away with ambition and passion right away. But as much as possible, are we able to inject selflessness into that tendency?
I think, you know, we have somehow answered more or less the next question, but anyway, the question is it fine to have spiritual ambitions and spiritual desires? One question is it wrong to have ambition? So it's almost like in succession now you have answered that. Now tell me, so is it fine to have spiritual ambition and desire? That's the question next.
Right, I think it's the same thing as one of the philosophers would say. An angry man, he became a sage, so he became an angry sage. You know, many times your base tendency actually does not change. And we often think that a spiritual person would be like this. You know, he would be very calm and he would be very... I mean, that is one thing which always used to strike me when I used to listen to Swami's discourse. Because Swami's discourse had so much passion, apart from the other things. There was so much vigor and energy in it. It was not like eyes half closed and as though you're in half sleep and half meditation and you're giving a very peaceful, calm... You know, that's how spirituality is being marketed these days.
Exactly.
But Swami did not do that. When Swami spoke, there was fire, you know, in his eyes. So if you think that things like passion and ambition do not go hand in hand with saintlyhood and spirituality, I think Swami disproved all that. What is necessary is, at the end of the day, why you're doing whatever you're doing for. I think that's what differentiates a spiritual man from an ordinary man.
Another angle on the same question is, if I have to have a spiritual ambition, it is like 10 years from now, I have to improve, I have to grow. It's like if we equate it with worldly ambition, in the sense, you know, my company is today a $1 million company. 10 years from now, I want it to be a $1 billion company. That way, if I don't know if the question was aligned that way, as to can we have such spiritual goals and ambitions and desires to attain, I feel it becomes tough in the spiritual field, because unless we experience the ultimate, we don't know what is the ultimate. We have no idea. You know, in a worldly sense, I know what it is to be a $1 billion company, but here I don't know what it is. And as you said, we have all wrong notions of a spiritually elevated person, that he should be having only a loincloth, he should always be smiling. I mean, whatever gunas we put, whatever qualities, traits we put for a spiritually realized person will all be wrong. Because there we have somebody who smokes a bidi and cigarette and he is a realized master. There is somebody else who eats meat and he is a realized master. In fact, that has given rise to many doubts and questions that he is eating meat, so why can't I eat meat? I mean, that's a different question. We will answer some other time possibly. But there is no proper definition as to what is the spiritual ultimate.
Right.
You know, I think we dealt with this in our satsang on how do I measure spiritual progress.
Right.
So this question I also feel tends towards that, how to measure spiritual progress. And dear listeners, if you have missed that satsang, please go and listen to the satsang. It was an entire 1.5 hours. Did we do 2 sessions of that?
Yeah, I think we did 2 sessions, right?
In that sense, if it is spiritual ambition and desire, it goes to how do I measure my spiritual progress? Well, that satsang is the answer. We will not go into detail now. But the answer we arrived to over there was again, yatna prayatnumal manava dharmamu, jaya pajaya mullu daiva dinamu, which is efforts lie in our hands, results in His. When we are on the spiritual path, our spiritual progress is taken care by the Master. We have to just ensure that we are putting in our efforts.
And there's a reason why you can only enjoy the efforts and not the result. Because one of the philosophers, he puts it very beautifully. He says, if you have to seek anything, why didn't you seek $1,000,000? Why do you want to seek self-realization?
Hmm.
You know, the disciples would be put off guard when he would say this, because he would in the end explain that if you get $1,000,000, you will be there to enjoy it. But if you get self-realization, you will not be there to enjoy it.
Hmm.
You know, this individual entity which is putting this effort is the one very one which is going to vanish when you get self-realized. So maybe that is why Swami often will say that you can only enjoy the effort. So enjoy the effort. Don't worry about the result which is going to come.
The ultimate result, you don't exist.
You don't exist to enjoy that result.
Well, I think, Prem, we have time to take just one more question. We had just 2 questions left. And the next question is like a modern day question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is how we want. Like we are presented with 100 cars and we say, you know, you just tell us which is the cheapest and best car. We are given 20 options to travel to Bombay. No, which is the cheapest and best and fastest way? So this is a time of shortcuts and quick remedies. So the next question is, what is the perfect way to pray to God so that He responds? You know, you leave aside all these things. You just tell me how I should pray so that God responds. So that is the next question.
Oh, that's a really tough one, because had we cracked that, then we would have...
You know, Prem, I remember a story.
There was this guy
who finds an old lamp. Okay. He picks it up. He looks. It's looking very interesting, antique. So he wipes it with a cloth.
Mm-hmm.
It starts shining. And when he wipes it a little more, a genie appears.
Okay.
He says, Master, I am here to grant 3 wishes. Ask what you want. He says, wow. He says, you know what? First thing I want is a palatial home which is studded with gold. And genie laughs and tells, you idiot, if I had that, do you think I would be living in a lamp? And he goes back into the lamp. So it's literally like that. Had we known the perfect way to pray, I mean, would we be sitting here and talking and discussing? Yes.
Right. I think what we started with, you know, when we spoke about answers and questions, and it all lies in the questions, I think this journey itself is that you pray, and you are bound to fail. I'm telling you that.
If it's a request.
Right. It's not that every time you pray, what you ask for, you will get. But this very desire to know what is the best way to pray to Swami. You know, what is the best attitude with which to pray to Swami. Because, you know, we are putting a petition in front of Swami. Let's say you're writing a petition to the court of law. You find that it's being rejected. So then you say, okay, maybe I need more evidences to, you know, add to it. Or I need to word this petition in a different way. So you're always trying to better the way you present your case, right? I think it's the same thing with your journey with God in the sense of prayer too. Because what you get at the end of prayer is, you may get it, you may not get it, but the process of prayer purifies, and I think that is what prayer does to us. If it is told to us, maybe we will not pray at all. Saying that, you know, you will not get what you pray for, but the prayer will purify you. But I think the essence is that all prayer is meant to purify you. And I think this desire to find out, how do I pray? How better do I pray? And I think what we in the worldly sense do is, especially when somebody like Swami is in our midst, you know, we try to flog to those people who have got the opportunity. You know, I see somebody who has become a student and I want to become a student. I go and ask them, what did you do? You became a student. Because we say that you've prayed in a certain manner which has worked. So tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whenever people come and ask me like that, or because some of us are accidental students. Some of us have put efforts, as you said.
And there are many out there who have put efforts,
right,
who's in the worldly sense deserve
exactly
it much more, but have not got it.
What you said about activity and inactivity.
Huh.
In one hand, you see people who have done enough effort to earn it, but they've not got it. On the other hand, people just seem to be getting it, you know, just
in spite of them not wanting
to
come
on their platter. So there is no perfect way to say that this is what works. And I think the search for that perfect way is what really works.
You know, that brings us to one beautiful thing about prayer. We think prayer is talking to God or prayer is whatever thing. You know, I feel that prayer is more of an attitude.
Very true.
So you don't need to actually verbalize it. You don't need to sit in a separate place. You don't need to clean a area and face towards a direction or anything like that. Prayer is just the attitude with which we live our life. And what is the best attitude? It is the ultimate in the ninefold path, you know. Atmanivedanam, that of complete surrender. And what is complete surrender? Swami has defined it saying, complete surrender is your ability to tell yourself that this is good for me. That's why it's happening to me. Irrespective of what happens to you. Keep telling yourself, this is good for me, this is good for me, this is good for me. So then imagine, we will be celebrating every moment of our life. And every prayer of ours will be getting fulfilled because our prayer is, whatever is happening is good for me. Which leads to that my life is simply only goodness. You know, that is why prayer, I feel, is an attitude of sharanagati, of surrender, of being in sync with God. Because I know the Lord is the most loving. I know the Lord is the most powerful. Therefore, I know that something, in quotes, bad, which I think is happening to me, is not because God wants to exact revenge on me. Because He is the most loving. And it's not as if there's some force that has overpowered the protective aura of my Lord and come and hit me, because I know my Lord is all powerful. In spite of that, if this is happening, that means my Lord has allowed it. And if He has allowed it, it's for my good. You know, this kind of being in sync with God is the ultimate prayer, is what truly prayer is. I remember somebody asked a question. You know, Swami often tells the story.
Mm-hmm.
He leaves it at the story, saying that there is this farmer who wants rain, so because he's decided to sow his seeds today. On the other end of the village, there's another farmer who's decided to conduct the wedding of his daughter, and therefore he doesn't want rains. And Swami would often say, see, like this the prayers are. And he would stop it there. I went further thinking, whose prayer do you think Swami, God will listen to? The farmer who's praying not for rains, the farmer who is praying for rains. And the answer that I got was, God has already decided whether it should rain or not. The farmer who was in sync with God will find his prayer being answered. If you are in sync with God, you will realize that having no rains is good. You will realize that having rains is good, irrespective of what happens. And therefore, when you are in sync with God, all your prayers seem to be getting answered, because when you are in sync with God, there is no separate thing as your own will. Whatever happens, you accept it as His will, as what is best for you. And that is surrender. And I feel therefore that prayer is more of an attitude of surrender. And the more we are able to surrender when we pray, saying that, Lord, whatever happens is for the good. With that attitude, when we, whatever we pray, that is the best prayer.
Very beautiful. I think in a sense you've summed up the whole thing. It is like, see, whatever we do, whether we pray, let me say I earn money, I put it in the bank, I do some savings, everything is so that we want to be at peace, right?
Correct.
We want to be at peace with ourselves, with the surroundings, with what happens with us. And we attain that peace in many, many ways. One is ensuring through our actions that nothing goes wrong. The other thing is through prayer, so that we are secured. And the third thing is through acceptance. And I think we are juggling with these three throughout life. And slowly in this journey called our devotion and, you know, spirituality going towards Swami, this component of acceptance and surrender is slowly growing and growing and growing, till it completely encompasses your whole attitude towards life. I think effort will be there, and you know, your effort, and your prayer also has an effort. You know, till then prayer is also part of the efforts that you do. What you do to secure your life, prayer is part of that. And I think slowly prayer goes beyond that boundary and says prayer has stopped being an effort, but prayer is becoming an act of surrender and acceptance.
Lovely.
I think that is the culmination of prayer as a journey.
So, dear listeners, we just hope that you enjoyed. And these were some of the questions. I think we have completed the list of questions that we gathered from the previous few months. So, thank you to all our listeners who sent in these questions, who made us think and introspect. We hope that this session was helpful for you. All your feedback is definitely very, very welcome, because as you can see, sometimes the entire satsang gets constructed based on your feedback. You can write into listener@radiosai.org. with gratitude to Swami and all our listeners, with gratitude to Swami who is sitting here in our studios and guiding us, showering us with all love and grace, we bring this afternoon satsang to a close with a song.
Satyavacham Madhurageetam Nityashilam Tatvabuddhim Bhaktibhavam Padapadme Itham Sarvam Samvide. Sagar Sai Nath
Sri Sagar Sai Nath.